Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Jackie Robinson integrated baseball in 1947. Willie Thrower was the first black NFL quarterback more than half a century ago. That seems like ancient history in a way, but remember, it's only been 4 years since we got our first African-American individual gold medalist. There are still racial lines in sports that have yet to be crossed. But when the Olympic Games begin tonight in Vancouver, we'll get one more first. The world's first black figure skating pair will glide onto the ice and into the history books. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur skating for France, but with the eyes of the world upon them. They are the French national champions, carrying the torch for minority athletes around the globe. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 12th. And you know, John, it's a statistic that surprised me. It's only been 4 years since the first African-American won an individual gold medal in the Winter Olympics.
Another reason to tune into figure skating. Believe me, figure skating is hard for me. So thanks.
Really?
Thanks for the story.
Well, you're a guy.
I guess. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Former President Bill Clinton out of a New York City hospital and back at his home in Chappaqua this morning following yesterday's heart procedure. Clinton's longtime friend Terry McAuliffe tells CBS News, don't expect the former president to slow down any time soon.
He was on the conference call as he was wheeled into the operating room. His aide, Doug Band, had to literally take the phone away from him. Yeah. He would have kept the phone on Haiti and talked right through the procedure if he could, but that's who he is.
President could be back at work as early as Monday. 1 month ago today, the earth shook for 40 terrifying seconds in Haiti, leaving about 200,000 people dead or near dead and leveling most of the capital city. It's a national day of mourning today with a ceremony to be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. Rolandra's Prophet, a Haitian teacher, tells our partner, the BBC, this morning, the disaster has brought Haitians closer together.
You know, the earthquake is now definitely a landmark in the life of this nation. Now, people are very united. People have come together. So we can say it's like a patriotic day where people like come together and see themselves as Haitians and that they have to like rely on each other.
Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Rico Dupuy, who runs a Haitian radio station, Radio Soleil, right here in New York City.
This earthquake has hit not the country of Haiti, but the Haitian nation, which is form of Haitians in Haiti and Haitians overseas in the diaspora.
At 4:53 Eastern, the exact time the earthquake hit, what Rico calls the Haitian nation is being asked to kneel and pray.
A disturbing story out of Ohio. A new report on human trafficking estimates that about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade in Ohio every year. It also says about 800 immigrants are sexually exploited and pushed into sweatshop-style jobs. Celia Williamson joins us now. She's a professor in the University of Toledo's Social Work Department. She's leading the research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission, which published its latest report on Monday. Celia, people don't often associate human trafficking with American cities. How big of a problem is this in the U.S.?
Oh, I think we're just starting to uncover that it's a large problem here.
And is it possible that a kid can get involved in this without a parent knowing?
Oh, yeah. There are several trafficking techniques used to manipulate and really trap youth into the sex trade.
Okay, we're going to talk more about this with Celia Williamson in just a moment. For the first time in 50 years, a Kennedy will not be serving in Congress. Here's a clip from a video that will air over the weekend from Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy, son of the late Ted Kennedy.
Now, having spent 2 decades in politics, my life is taking a new direction, and I will not be a candidate for re-election this year.
Patrick Kennedy served 8 terms in Congress. And the Winter Olympics beginning in Vancouver today, the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. And in honor of the Olympics, we're asking you about this year's games. If you had a chance to be in the Olympics, what event would you choose to compete in? You can even make up one if it doesn't exist. But give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Better than expected retail sales in January, and Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are down still. The Dow gets underway at 10,144, the S&P at 1,078. The NASDAQ opens at 2,177. Coming up, more details of that disturbing sex trade story out of Ohio.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
You know, when I read the results of a report on human trafficking yesterday, I thought I'd read it wrong. It said about 1,000 American-born children are forced into the sex trade every year. And I expected that to be 1,000 every year out of the nation. That's 1,000 in the state of Ohio alone. It's a stunning statistic. Joining us to talk about it again is Celia Williamson, a professor at the University of Toledo. She is leading research efforts at the Ohio Trafficking in Persons Study Commission that published that report on Monday. And we also have Teresa Flores with us. She was an actual victim of human trafficking, and she's author of the book The Slave Across the Street, The True Story of How an All-American Teenager Survived the World of Human Trafficking. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Celia, this report that you have issued, like I said, I thought that would be 1,000 out of the country. That's 1,000 out of Ohio. What do these numbers look like when you spread them across the country?
Well, there's been several estimates. The government estimate has been about 17,500, but their study methodology is very elusive and not very well done, even admitted by them. Other studies have been over 72,000 just coming through the southwest border as international victims. And then there hasn't been a large study done in a meaningful way in terms of domestic children, American-born children, but the estimates are about 100,000.
What is the typical story here? Who is this that is victimizing children, and what are they forcing them to do?
Well, I think they're organized. Well, I know they're organized sex trafficking rings happening around the nation, and they're manipulating and forcing children into the sex trade. And it has become the second largest illegal enterprise in the world, human trafficking, and it's a booming business in the U.S.
Teresa, you were actually a victim of sex trafficking. This began when you were 15 years old. Can you tell us how this began and how you got trapped into continuing this?
It really, you know, the same way it happens now is I was vulnerable and I moved around a lot. So I didn't have a really good support network around me. I didn't have, you know, aunts and uncles or grandparents that I could talk to or that would notice any of the red flags, any of the changes in me. And, you know, was just targeted by a group of men who saw this, and they used a technique that is very common even today, in that they showed, you know, one of them showed me a lot of attention, and, you know, it's called grooming, where they give you a lot of love and tell you how wonderful you are, and then something very simple, they just offered me a ride home from school one day, and ended up taking me not to home, but to his home, and giving me a pop that was laced with some sort of drug and raped me. And then I found out later that they there was other people there, and they had taken pictures of the rape and then essentially blackmailed me into earning them back.
So this was a young man that you thought was going to be a boyfriend, and in fact it got you into the sex trade because he threatened to show these photos of you to your parents and to the school, and your parents did not know this was going on. How is that possible?
It's very, you know, very possible, very easy. When your life is on the line and someone's telling you that they're going to kill you and your family, you go to all lengths to keep that quiet. So, you know, it was very easy to keep that from them.
But how did it work? Were you going out and doing this activity with your parents not knowing? How did that actually function?
What happens is I had a private phone in my room, and so they would call my room, and my dad traveled a lot, so he was gone about 3 weeks out of the month on business. And, you know, my mom was the kind of mom that when you went to bed, you said goodnight and you went into your rooms and you shut your door and you saw each other the next day. And so they would call my room and say, you need to appear immediately. And so I would essentially just sneak out and go to a different street behind my house, and a car and driver would be waiting.
Teresa, can you tell me, I mean, you've become an activist on this issue. How do we deal when we find out cases of human trafficking? What happens to these girls?
Well, say that again, when we find the cases?
When we find these cases, how does it work through our system?
You know, that's a good question, because we know that the FBI knows that they're there, law enforcement, but it's really difficult because there's no place to put them once we get them and rescue them. So there's very few social services and shelters and places out there to take them to. So they usually end up in jail, like detention center, or into a foster care home.
Celia, is our system set up? I mean, we don't obviously have good research on this issue, but is our legal system, our law enforcement system, set up to take care of this problem?
Absolutely not. Actually, I went to a meeting in Washington, D.C. about this issue across the U.S., and one of the main problems was that the criminal justice, the social service, and the healthcare system are not educated about this issue. They don't know how to identify victims, and they are our first responders. But on top of that, when our child victims are rescued from trafficking, they're often incarcerated in detention centers across the U.S., despite the fact that under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which is a federal law that says any child under the age of 18 that is involved in prostitution is a victim of the crime of human trafficking, cities across the U.S. are still incarcerating our kids.
Well, Teresa Flores is now the director of awareness and training at Grace Haven. That's a shelter for girls that's not quite opened yet. Teresa, do you have advice for parents on how to keep this from happening to their own kids?
Yeah, I mean, there are red flags, and they need to find out what those are and look for them and be observant and just keep good communication open with their child. If you see something, you know, don't assume that it's just a teenager, you know, going through hormones. You know, ask and find out where they're going, and check on them in the middle of the night. You know, you have to get up in the middle of the night and see if they're in their bed. I mean, it's just simple things like that.
Be nosy with your kids, I guess. Teresa Flores was a victim of trafficking at the age 15. She's the author of The Slave Across the Street, the true story of how an all-American teenager survived the world of human trafficking. And Celia Williamson also joined us, professor in the University of Toledo's School of Social Work. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the top stories.
The Winter Olympics are nearly upon us in Vancouver, British Columbia. U.S. Olympic ski jumper Emily Cook told NBC Sports this morning she's looking forward to tonight's opening ceremony.
Just looking up and looking around and seeing everybody, you know, cheering us on and, you know, just feeling all that support is really the most exciting thing ever.
And for the next 2 weeks, we're going to hear voices like that quite a lot. In other news, the people of Haiti are holding a national day of mourning today, exactly a month after the earthquake struck. A ceremony will be held later close to the devastated cathedral in the capital, Port-au-Prince. A Haitian teacher told our partner, the BBC, this morning that people who haven't found the remains of their family members have mixed feelings about today's commemorations.
Today, people are trying to remember those they have lost, but at the same time, you have people, still have family members, mothers, fathers, or sons, who are still under the doorbells, and they haven't pulled these people out yet.
Several large circus tents previously used by Cirque du Soleil are on their way to Haiti to be used as temporary headquarters for the Haitian government.
Former President Bill Clinton is at home in Chappaqua, New York, recovering from a procedure yesterday to unclog an artery close to his heart. Doctors say his prognosis is excellent. And in Georgia, a soldier who refused to be deployed to Afghanistan will not face a court-martial. Alexis Hutchinson is a single mother who argued she had no one to care for her infant son. She's facing demotion and will lose all military and veteran benefits. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up...
Labels do matter, because without labels and mental illness, you could not get treatment.
We talked about the importance of labels for psychiatrists, and today you've told us about how important they are to you. We're going to get your responses in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now we have some takeouts on stories that we're following this week, and it was 1 month ago today that the earth shook for 40 terrifying seconds in Haiti. 40 seconds that left around 200,000 people dead and leveled most of the capital city. It is a national day of mourning there today, with a ceremony to be held in the ruins of the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. We turn now to Gypsy Metalou. She's the executive director of Saint-Lan, a Haitian neighborhood center in Miami. Gypsy, are there events going on in Miami today to observe this day of mourning?
Yes, good morning, Celeste. There are a number of events and especially prayer services, prayer vigils, to honor the memory of all the victims, as well as, you know, to encourage the survivors.
We've heard a lot about how the community in South Florida especially is drawn closer to Haiti in the wake of this tragedy. And I'm wondering if we're starting to see those bonds begin to loosen as a month has gone by.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If anything, those bonds that had always been there, and they tended to be strengthened in the wake of every natural disaster we've known in Haiti, you know, the earthquakes and the like. But I think that this earthquake has really, I think, solidified those bonds and in fact garnered additional support from non-Haitians. That's really been very tremendous. The outpouring of support from just about everyone throughout the United States and throughout the world has been unprecedented, and I think that's been unique,
Gypsy,
really, in the history of disasters.
Gypsy Metalou, an executive director of Saint-Lan, a Haitian neighborhood center in Miami.
Our next takeout from Washington, Todd Zwillick, D.C. correspondent, joins us. Todd, a jobs bill from the Democrats seems to be a test of this new bipartisanship they're talking about. How's it going?
Well, it was, John, but the bipartisanship part of it isn't going well at all. It was, well, in a Washington kind of way, sort of exciting yesterday, I guess, when the Finance Committee was working on a bipartisan jobs bill. They had buy-in from some senior Republicans. Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, rolled out this draft bill, and Republicans were on board. It had job-building measures. It had some reforms to the estate tax. It had some other things, some routine tax extenders that Republicans wanted. And everyone was kind of getting used to the feeling of bipartisanship because they haven't flexed those muscles in so long. And then it took a couple of hours for Harry Reid to yank the bill and say he wasn't going to put it on the floor. Instead, he's going with something much, much more narrow, as sort of a narrow job-creating package, supposed to be a job-creating package that has some tax credits for small business, some incentives for states to spend some money on infrastructure. But it doesn't have any of the stuff that Republicans wanted that got them on board, and Republicans reacted angrily. They said Harry Reid went partisan and yanked the rug out from under them right as they were making progress. So this thing's going to get voted on after the President's Day recess, but right now the bipartisanship seems to have waned a little bit.
And is there a backstory here?
There doesn't seem to be. Harry Reid, I don't think it's personal or anything like that. Harry
right.
Reid said that he thought that this bipartisan package was going to lose support among his liberals, the liberal Senate Democrats. But, you know, they don't want the estate tax reformed in a way that's an advantage to the super rich. That was their problem. So he saw this thing possibly teetering, and I don't think that he feels they can afford a defeat right now with the way the jobs market is.
All right, Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, talking about the jobs bill and bipartisanship not in Washington.
And our last takeout is about the power of labels.
Labels do matter, because without labels and mental illness, you could not get treatment.
We talked yesterday about the American Psychiatric Association's DSM, the manual that decides how we label all types of mental disorders, and we've been getting your stories on the effects that labels have, like this one from Sabrina in Harlem.
If I didn't have the correct diagnoses, I wouldn't have the correct drugs and be able to get the funding for the hospitalizations, et cetera, that I really needed to get through my life to the point where I'm actually functional after a number of years of just a complete mess.
Like everything, it's a two-way street. Brad's a counselor in Oklahoma. He tells us on our site, thetakeaway.org, I've found in the people I work with that a label can be distressing or leave someone with an equal but opposite sense of relief. Much of what a label means is based in what importance the person being labeled places upon the diagnosis that's declared. I found one of the single most damaging labels has been over the over-diagnosing of youth with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, I don't know where I come down on this issue here, but I was glad to hear this listener in Michigan calling 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Labels, yes, while they do help when you finally find out that you have a mental illness, and so there is help out there, such as my bipolar, but they also hurt your children and people who love you when they hear people banter it around and call other people that name or any other kind of names. They hurt, and it also leaves the next generation wondering, am I next?
Social worker named Allie wrote in to tell us this. My concern is that in some cases, when a family is desperate to pin a label on their child and blame the child for behaviors that actually stem from the family's dysfunction, it is easier in those cases for the family to point to the child and say, you are experiencing these issues because there is something wrong with you, insert diagnosis here, rather than the parents taking responsibility for their role in the child's behavior. That's a big debate among psychiatrists. That's
true. Yeah, we have some really compelling conversations going back and forth, and if you want to continue that conversation, you can go to our website. You can also re-listen to the segment about this and share it with your family and friends and ask them to weigh in. That's thetakeaway.org. You can reach us anytime with whatever has you thinking at 877-8 My Take. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Winter Olympics, and we're going to speak with the first black ice skating figure skating pair, how they found each other. Here's a hint, not very far off from something like eHarmony. But we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were going to be in the Winter Olympics? And yes, you can make up your own. Somebody calling herself Brooklyn Chick posts to our site, identifying celebrity voiceovers on commercials. Hey, couch potatoes need the Olympics too.
Is that winter? Yeah, I guess that would be winter.
It could be winter. Yeah, because you're indoors. Yeah, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to kick off the games with what to watch for in the games.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, assessing the state of the Iranian opposition with someone from the BBC Persian Service, and Gary Sick, analyst from Columbia University. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour, 1 month after the earthquake. It's a day of mourning in Haiti to mark the one-month anniversary of the earthquake, which left around 200,000 people dead and a million homeless.
In Afghanistan, tribal elders are asking NATO forces to wage their imminent offensive on the Taliban stronghold of Marja quickly and carefully to protect civilians in and around the town. Captain Joshua Rinfrey is a Marines company commander on the front line near Marja.
I'm expecting some fairly significant resistance, especially within the first few days that we go in.
As many as 1,000 Taliban fighters are believed to be dug in. And let the games begin. The Winter Olympics in Vancouver get underway today with the first ever indoor opening ceremonies tonight. U.S. Olympic freestyle ski jumper Jarrett Speedy Peterson tells NBC News.
It's one of my favorite part of the Olympics is getting to walk into opening ceremonies.
Good thing it's indoors since the forecast calls for rain tonight and throughout the weekend. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow is down about 87, the S&P down about 8, and the NASDAQ down about 20. So those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So yesterday, a lot of the media was focused on Iran, where there were demonstrations on both sides, pro and anti-government, for the 31st anniversary of the beginning of the Islamic Revolution that transformed Iran, certainly transformed the Middle East, and has been a theme in U.S.-Iranian relations, of course, ever since. Joining us now to sort of take a look at what happened yesterday and try to figure out what it means for going forward is Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's interactive show Your Turn. He's been covering Wednesday's protests for our partner, the BBC, and the BBC Persian TV is based in London, where he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also, Gary Sick, an Iran expert at Columbia University with long experience analyzing and studying Iran, also joins us from New York City. Gary, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, Gary Sick, what did you make of what happened yesterday? Is it possible to score the opposition and the government? It seemed as though the government was able to project that it has the upper hand here.
I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, the government won this battle, and part of, I think the only reason why they won the battle is that they have actually mastered some of the techniques. They've learned how to really turn off the internet quite effectively. They had their troops out in very strategic locations. They jumped on every small demonstration the moment it began to appear. They beat up leaders of the opposition when they tried to make an appearance. And at the same time, they bussed in massive numbers of people for a show of force, and it was a one-sided operation. And I think the opposition is going to have to rethink itself.
Siavash Ardalan from the BBC Persian TV service. Yesterday on this program, Stephen Kinzer, who's written a lot about Iran, suggested that there's a constraint and dynamic going on in the opposition that, based on the experience of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians fear another big revolution and fear perhaps the pendulum swinging all the way in the other direction here. And as a result, they're inclined to go much more cautiously. Do you buy that theory?
Well, this is really the essence of the soul-searching that's going on right now among the freedom movement. Many of them are supporting this idea, including its leader, Mir Hossein Mousavi, himself being a revolutionary. He now supports the idea of reform and is emphasizing that we're not trying to overthrow the government. What we're simply pursuing are reforms within the Constitution. If there's any changes in the Constitution that are to be made, it should be done through peaceful means. Yet, the Green Movement, you know, covers a vast array of predispositions and of political thinking, many of them also inclined towards more violent upheaval. And this is a conversation that's going on amongst them as we speak.
Gary Sick, is reform possible given the constraints within the Iranian government and the kinds of crackdowns that you've already talked about?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that the opposition started out being very mild, actually calling for rather small reforms and small changes. They have become more and more demanding as time goes on and as the repression has grown. And I think what's going to happen now is either that the regime permits a reformist group to actually operate as an opposition, or you're going to see it go underground even more and become more radical and be taken over by people who really do want to overthrow the government and will do so violently. I think the tactics of the government are understandable in the sense that they've discovered how to actually manage repression effectively. But I think in the short term that may help them, but in the long term it actually undercuts their legitimacy, and that is essentially... That's their strongest card, mm-hmm. and they're losing that all the time.
And, you know, a nuclear physicist will tell you that crowing about having 20% enriched uranium is kind of like crowing about having a bunch of X-ray machines. It's not even close to what it would take to make weaponized uranium. Nevertheless, President Ahmadinejad yesterday declared Iran a nuclear power because of this 20% enriched uranium. Does he have an argument, and does it resonate with the people?
I believe this is the third time he has announced that Iran is a nuclear nation, so I don't think there's anything new in that. This is something that he trots out every time there's a major national holiday. Basically, they can enrich uranium to 20%. They can go beyond that if they want to. The trick is not to sit back and say, oh my goodness, they must be building a bomb because they've got half a gram of enriched uranium, but to say, all right, how do we stop them from going on from here? And I think that's the point where the West and the United States really don't, they haven't got an answer to that.
Siavash Ardalan, finally, you know, you talked about an internal conversation that's taking place within the opposition. I'm wondering if the techniques that Gary Sick has talked about of controlling the information flow, particularly in the internet, are lessons that may be drawn by other nations, say China, even the U.S., in trying to control information. This was an unprecedented moment yesterday.
Absolutely. I think as time goes on, as the state realizes how are the best ways to deal with the opposition, they're learning their lessons. And yesterday showed that they've done their homework as well, bringing down the internet connections down to a crawl, and not just with the internet connection and the what's going on in cyberspace, but the country has virtually changed into a police state over the past few weeks. They've just embarked on this massive campaign of intimidation and arresting journalists, bloggers, minorities, and people we don't even sometimes hear about because their families don't want news of it to be leaked. So the government is learning how to repress the opposition better, but the opposition has a problem of trying to find different ways, creative ways of dealing with this. And so far, the best idea they've come up with so far has been to try to hijack some of these state-sanctioned anniversaries.
Right.
And come out to the streets. But I think they've exhausted this method.
Siavash Ardalan, host of the BBC Persian TV's program, Your Turn. Gary Sick, is President Ahmadinejad out of the woods here in the moments before we go?
Absolutely not. He's being opposed by people in his own party and is anything but a popular figure at this point.
More to come out of Iran. Gary Sick, Iran expert at Columbia University, talking about the protest during yesterday's 31st Islamic Revolution anniversary on the streets of Tehran. Coming up, merge the best parts of online dating with ice skating. And what do you get? The Winter Olympics' first black skating couple. How do they become a couple? You'll find out later on this hour. And we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? Make up one of your own. Mark posts to our site, Australian rules, curling, thin ice over deep water. Ooh. Nice. Darren simply writes, ice crunking. Yeah, but can you do that on the ice? Yeah. Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to your website, The Takeaway. Your website, that's right. It is their website. Takeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The fashion world lost an icon yesterday. Authorities found British fashion designer Alexander McQueen dead in his apartment in London. They suspect suicide. When McQueen started his career in London, Savile Row, the hub of old-school English tailoring, he made a name for himself by being a little what we might call cheeky. He described this in a 1997 interview on The Frank Skinner Show in Britain.
I'm in Savile Row with a load of old tailors, and you start padding the canvas, which makes the jacket. It just happens to be Prince Charles's jacket I was working on at the time. And so I draw this big willy on it.
Here to talk about the legacy of is New York Times fashion critic Kathy Horn, who wrote a lengthy profile on McQueen last year. Kathy, give us an idea of who Alexander McQueen was. Maybe people know him for designing Lady Gaga's lobster shoes that she wore in her Bad Romance video. But who was this man?
Well, he was a complicated guy who grew up in the East End of London. His father was a taxi driver. He was very close to his mother, Joyce, who just passed away about a week ago. He went to Central St. Martin's, which is one of the top schools in London, but as you heard on that clip, he was also trained on Savile Row. You know, he was a very smart guy who could be very funny, very brash with people, super hardworking guy, I think a very hard partier too if he wanted to. And then of course we in the fashion world we knew him for these incredible shows that he did over the last 15 years. I think that he was he was one of those really exceptional people in the business for being intelligent and also being incredibly capable with his hands. So he got the conceptual part of fashion, that fashion was more than just wearable, you know, clothes. But at the same time, he could make anything. He did his own patterns.
His runway shows were known for being more performance art than just a strict fashion show, and yet he was himself a kind of a modest individual coming from working class backgrounds, and he wasn't necessarily one of the outsized fame seekers that we know of in the fashion world.
Well, I think he's the real deal. I think he was a super talent, and I think when Lee, everybody knew him as Lee because that was his first name. When, you know, Lee was very interested in the work. He loved going into the studio. He loved working with all those people, getting the things done, making things the way he wanted to. I think he thought a lot about being the 21st century designer. And as you said, he was a really kind, decent, super sensitive, nice guy. He told you what he thought about stuff. He didn't hold back on anything like that. But another, I think that was one of the I wouldn't know if whether it's a conflict or a dichotomy in Lee, that he did come from this working class background. He did spend almost all of his life until the last year or two living in the East End of London. His business was still based there, although he did show in Paris for a while. He worked for the House of Givenchy, a couture house. So he certainly knew a lot of the really good contemporary British artists. So he could travel in that world. He could work at the very heights of fashion.
And his death has cast a somber mood over the New York Fashion Week, which began this Wednesday. Reports of a possible suicide of the British designer Alexander McQueen. That's Kathy Horn. She's the fashion critic for our partner, The New York Times.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, you're going to meet a couple people who will be appearing in the Olympics, a couple who met on the internet through a sort of skaters online dating service. And they're also about to set some history as well. We'll talk to them in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. January was better than expected for the nation's retailers. The Commerce Department says retail sales rose 0.5% last month. That's the best showing since November and higher than economists expected. The Mid-Atlantic has been snowed in for days, and now it's the South's turn to get it. A rare winter storm along the Gulf Coast has already left Texas with more than a foot of snow, and parts of Louisiana got at least 5 inches before dawn.
They could use it up in Vancouver, where the Winter Olympics is about to kick off tonight. The South is getting the Winter Olympics snow. There isn't as much as usual, but it's not expected to stop the opening ceremonies, which are later today. In the U.S., former President Bill Clinton back home in Chappaqua, New York, after a procedure yesterday to unclog an artery to his heart. Doctors say his prognosis is excellent. And despite the positive economic news this morning, stocks are falling along with oil. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, all 30 stocks are down. This morning it's below 140 points lower at the open. Finally, the man credited with inventing the Frisbee, one of the world's most popular toys, has died at the age of 90. Walter Frederick Morrison developed his plastic flying discs during the 1950s. Over the next half century, hundreds of millions of Frisbees were sold worldwide. There's even a game, Frisbee Golf. Do you play that with Grant?
No.
Frisbee Golf? My brother is a big Frisbee Golf player. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Ask any Paris figure skater, and they'll tell you that sometimes finding their match on the ice is more complicated and more difficult than finding a match off the ice. That's why there's actually an online pairs figure skating introduction site. It's like a match.com, but it's exclusively for skaters who are looking to find a skating partner. And that's how our next guests met. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonheur were set up on icepartnersearch.com. They're about to compete in their first Olympic match as a team. They are the French national champions. They're skating for France this weekend, and they will be the first black pairs skating team ever to compete in the Olympic Games. Vanessa, let's start with you. Can you explain to our listeners what makes finding a match so difficult that you had to turn to a kind of blind dating sort of website in order to find your partner, Yannick?
There are so few boys, actually, in figure skating, and also there are few boys that are strong enough or tall enough or experienced enough. So it is difficult. We have more girls in figure skating than boys, so it's always difficult to find a boy and then someone that you're compatible with. So
kind of the same problem we all had in fourth grade square dancing class, right?
Exactly.
So Yannick, Vanessa flew out to France, and she did an audition with you. How did that audition go?
Really good. First impression was perfect. It was really connected together. I felt something with Vanessa. It was really great.
How did you know she was the one? You got a few responses from the website.
Yes, I was a few responses from a Canadian or U.S. girl. But at the beginning doesn't work, and we saw Vanessa. I saw a few videos from her, and when we got on the ice and tried a few elements, I knew it was her.
Vanessa, did you have the same instant connection?
Yes, we both knew that we wanted to skate together within the first day of skating together. And after the first 3 days, it was perfect, and we had already made our decision. We always laughed. All the elements worked really well, and we both looked very nice. We have really good lines on the ice.
But you had an accident during your early training, isn't that right?
It was the first day I came back to France to actually... I cut his hand the first day. Just before we were about to finish practice, we were actually in the middle of a spiral sequence, and I had to let go of my foot, and his hand just happened to be there. It was in my way.
That's not the most auspicious way to start a partnership together, but I guess it turned out pretty well. You guys experienced success pretty early on.
We've only been skating for 2 years, and at the Olympics, we'll be competing against couples that have been skating together from 5 years to 15 years. So we have accomplished a lot. We've done 2 European championships and a world championships where we got our place for the Olympics this year.
Now, because of the changing rules in terms of nationality and country of origin, we see all kinds of pairs of skaters who are born in different countries, hold multiple citizenships. And Vanessa, you're a really good example for that. Can you kind of give us an idea of your international status?
Yes, I have identity crisis. I was actually born in Canada. I have British citizenship through my parents, who are both British, and we've been living in the U.S. for about 10 years now. And I moved recently 2 years ago to France, and I now have French citizenship.
So do you feel any sense of, I guess, dislocation in terms of what country you're actually skating for and representing in the Olympics?
Yes. I wasn't sure what country I wanted to skate for because I had the opportunity to skate for many. I'm proud to represent France. I was very welcome to skate there, and I have Yannick's family who was very loving, and I spent Christmas with them, and all of France has been very supportive, and I found my perfect partner. So
Yannick, you were not looking to find a black partner. You were just looking for somebody with the athleticism and the kind of relationship that you needed, but you ended up with another black skater, and you're now going to be the first black figure skaters to perform as a team in the entire history of the Olympics.
Yes, that's true. The first time I just watch and search for a partner, and I found Vanessa. She's a black girl, but the first impression, we didn't think about that, and it's true now. Everybody talk about first black pair in Olympic. And we are actually really proud about that, and we want like push the pair skating for black, because there is no many, and we think we can arrive and be good.
Yeah.
Vanessa, can you tell me about what that moment was like? Maybe it was the moment when somebody first pointed it out to you or first asked you about it. How do you feel as the first black figure skaters in the Olympics? Was that a moment where you kind of went, whoa, wait, am I?
Yeah, we didn't really know if we were the first, because we know we have seen other black skaters in the sport, there's Robin, he's a German black skater, pair skater also, skating with a Ukrainian girl. There was also Sergio Bonnelly from France, but yes, when people told us we were the first, we were surprised, but very proud, and like Yannick said, we want to encourage other people to skate and to be the best in skating, because it is rare to see black skaters on the ice.
Do you feel like it puts pressure on you? I mean, there's going to be the eyes of thousands, perhaps millions of black kids from all over the world watching you guys as an example and role models.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's a lot of pressure. Not at all. We have pressure on ourselves for just skating for our country, for our families, for just for ourselves. And I think no matter what we do and how we skate, I think that we can represent all the other black children, and we can represent them just being at the Olympics and have reached this level already.
If I know nothing about this sport technically, what do you guys offer as a pair that I'm not going to see from another pair of skaters?
I think it is our athleticism and our color on the ice. I mean, it does stand out. It's beautiful against the white ice. And we're very athletic. We have very muscular bodies, and some of our throws are the best in the world. They're very high, and Yannick is very muscular, very strong, and
he's
our
tall.
Lifts are very good. So I think it's more that than anything else.
Would you agree with that, Yannick?
Yes, I totally agree with that.
Well, you guys make a very handsome pair. Vanessa James and Yannick Bonner, they're pairs of figure skaters that will be skating for France in the upcoming Olympics. Thanks, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
I will definitely give them the gold medal in confidence going to the Olympics. For more of the people behind the Olympics, you can listen back to our interviews from this week and all next week when we're covering the Olympics. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. And we're asking you, what event would you want to compete in if you were in the Olympics? And go ahead, make up one of your own.
This is Susan Miller from Manhattan. I would like to compete in the smorgasbording Olympics.
interesting. Bex posts to our site, I would have poker added to the Winter Games, but each nation's player would have to gamble with its country's GDP and do it naked outside in the snow, perhaps.
What?
So give it a winter
quality. They didn't write that.
No, they didn't write that. I just added that, but that's good. Tell us your take. 877-8-MINDTAKER posted to your website. Yes, it's your website, thetakeaway.org. There's also this special project that needs your photos. We're doing a dog show next week in honor of me being gone. Send us a photo of your pet, your four-legged dog. Three-legged dog's okay. Best in show will be judged by us and the listeners. Go to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee, giving a plug for my beagle.
Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. I'll be on vacation next week. Enjoy Todd Zwillick filling in for me. Does he have a dog? This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.